This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg
I'm Ken Nash. And later in the show, we're going to have on Ron Tabak, who is the president of New York Lawyers Against the Death Penalty.
But first, we're going to listen to Steve Cotterella, who is part of the Midnight Notes Collective, a journal of anti-capitalist works. Steve is a former labor union organizer for the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, now known as UNITE, and the Committee of Interns in Residence. Presently, he teaches at the New School and Montclair State College, and he was a Fulbright Scholar researching in Italy and the author of Workers of the World, African and Asian Migrants in Italy in the 1990s.
Steve, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you for inviting me and having me on.
When you say workers of the world, I always put the word unite after that, and I think we're going to have to see in what sense workers were uniting and are uniting in Italy and around the world. But tell us a bit about the book itself and how you came to write it.
Well, I researched the book from 1994 to 98, which I spent in northeastern Italy in a region called the Veneto, which includes cities such as Venice, Padua, Vicenza. And over those years, I interviewed hundreds of people who are living and working in Italy, from who are originally from countries of West Africa, the Middle East and North Africa, Eastern Europe and Asia. And the book traces their life stories, their trajectories, from what happened in their countries of origin, their areas of origin, their homes and their jobs and livelihoods in where they were born, and how they came to migrate and move as a solution to those problems that arose where they were living, to come to Italy, where they became part of a recomposition of the working class, a new part of the forms of work and of the labor movement in Italy.
Now, we've been seeing increased migration to this country and indeed to this city over the last decade or so. Is this part of an increased, the experience in Italy, is that also part of an increased migration to Italy and indeed to Europe?
Yes, very much so. The migrations going on around the world have a number of features in common and are really part of a single whole process that's happening worldwide. And that is that in the countries that the countries of Africa, Asia, Latin America, structural adjustment programs organized by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, I suspect listeners of WBAI and certainly any anti-globalization activists out there will be somewhat familiar with these programs, but maybe we can talk about what they entail later. But these programs have led to disruptions in the economies of people in the poorer countries of the world. And the migrations, whether from Mexico to New York or from China to New York or California or from Senegal or Morocco or Yugoslavia into Italy, are a response to the problems created by structural adjustment programs.
Tell us what you mean by structural adjustment programs now.
Well, structural adjustment program is a phrase of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, these two transnational institutions that were set up after World War II to govern the world monetary system. And essentially what happened is that after around the 1970s and 80s, most of the countries of the world, excluding most of the richest countries of Europe, Japan, and the U.S., but most of the other countries in the world found themselves heavily in debt from money they had borrowed to foster development programs, often by military governments and dictatorships. And the International Monetary Fund began to tell countries that if they wanted to continue to participate in the world economy, to receive credit, to be able to be involved in trade, they needed to carry out programs that involved getting their house in order from the point of view of the International Monetary Fund and the World Banking Establishment. These usually involve eliminating subsidies for basic necessities that governments had been forced by their people, by movements in these countries, to provide for their people. They involve cuts in social services, in education, in health care, often involve cracking down on unions or making labor legislation more draconian, involve raising tuition for education and so forth. So in a variety of ways, they make government programs that had made life possible in many cases and somewhat easier for people in countries such as in areas in Africa and Latin America and so forth, they had eliminated these programs and left people with no way to really make a living in many parts of the world.
So let's return to Italy now. Fill us in more about what's been happening, your experiences in Italy. You were an immigrant there also, right?
Well, I was briefly, actually. I went there originally with a small grant from SUNY Binghamton, where I did my PhD to begin the research. Then the money ran out. It was not a very large amount of money, and I wanted to continue the research, continue interviewing people. And so I stayed on and taught English. And at that time, the immigration law was changed under a new government in Italy so that one could not work under the conditions I was working in. I won't bother to go into the details, but I was essentially working off the books as an illegal immigrant myself and for a couple of years. And ironically,
that's a hell of a thing for a Fulbright scholar.
Well, the Fulbright came later. This is the
I'm glad they would have taken it away from you, Steve.
I then got a Fulbright, but for a while...
I think the Italian police are out there right now.
No, it was a very strange position to be in, actually. One day I was sort of having to try and handle my paperwork to kind of stay out of trouble, and you know, the next day I was, you know, a guest of Italian government officials to be interviewed about my project, so it was just an odd thing to be going through.
To internalize the pains and tribulations of being in a position where you were not legal in a country where you were intended to work.
Well, I saw what, you know, it had an impact on me, and yet at the same time, of course, being a U.S. citizen, in practice I was in very little danger. That is, the way in which someone from Nigeria or Senegal or Morocco was treated, if they were undocumented, and the way that I was treated as undocumented, were very different. At one point, in fact, police who I had gone to try and work out trying to get on the books and become legal had told me to just go out of the country and come right back the same day, go to Switzerland or something, and come back and get my passport stamped as a tourist. And since Americans can stay in Italy for 3 months without a visa, you know, it was no problem. That's obviously not available to someone from, you know, from Senegal, from Ghana, from Tunisia.
I know one of the things that you really specialize in within the context of your book and so on is beginning to look at the recomposition of the working class movements and the new alliances that form pursuant to these immigration phenomena. Delineate some of those conceptualizations for us.
Yeah, actually, I can give two or three examples, two from Italy and maybe one from recent events in the United States. In 1990, the Italian left was really in a very bad shape. The labor union movement had been somewhat shattered through the 1980s, which, like in the United States, were a very conservative period. And the left was in some real disarray. And it was really a movement of immigrants. There was a student movement in 1990 in Italy opposing privatization of universities. But then there was a movement of immigrants protesting violence against immigrants and demanding access to housing, demanding equal rights, demanding that undocumented immigrants receive amnesty. And there were a series of direct actions and civil disobedience by immigrants all across the country. And it was after that that leftists, that unions, that workers began to kind of come out of the woodwork again, that is, ones born in Italy, began to also move again politically, so that by the time of the Gulf War a year later, there was a large movement to oppose the Gulf War in Italy. A more recent situation that's going on today that your listeners should be aware of is that right now in Italy, there's a government of the far right. There's a government under the media tycoon Silvio Berlusconi, who owns most of the private media in Italy and heads a right-wing political party. He's in a governing coalition with the former fascist party, the National Alliance, and a movement called the Northern League, which wants to kick immigrants out of Italy, among other things. And they've proposed a change in immigration law that would not allow immigrants to stay in Italy if they didn't have a job, so that it's essentially an indentured servitude or even a semi-slavery system that's being proposed. There have been massive demonstrations to oppose this law. There were 100,000 people in Rome, mainly immigrant workers, recently, but also involving many Italians. And at the same time, this same government, which incidentally cracked a lot of heads in Genoa over the summer in the anti-globalization protests around the G8 meeting as well, this same government is proposing changing the labor law in Italy that stood for 30 years and to make it easier for employers to fire people. And There's going to be, at the end of this, in March 23rd, a demonstration in Rome that's expected to have well over 1 million people and might be the largest in the history of Italy. And then on April 5th, a general strike of the whole country to protest these proposed changes in the law. This is just one example of how the attempt to attack immigrant workers is vital to any attempt to attack the needs of workers as a whole now in every country. And at the same time, how the movements of immigrant workers and their struggles gives a certain vitalization, a kind of energy to the demands of the working class as a whole, so that without wanting to oversimplify or suggest that there's no strains or tensions, there's a way in which the two find themselves increasingly meeting each other, the two different kinds of working class struggles.
That sounds very similar to the guest worker provisions that the Bush administration was proposing before 9/11, which I assume they'll be reproposing later on. Let's bring that just for a bit back to the United States, and do you want to contrast and compare the situation here with what's going on in Italy and Europe?
You're talking about the guest workers that, of course, Bush was going to permit from Mexico that was coming in.
Yeah, specifically Mexico, yeah.
Yeah, first I just want to say how important it is for everybody with progressive politics and labor politics to oppose these kind of provisions. I mean, they're essentially a way of trying to take one group of workers, put them in a condition where their right to live, their right to even be in a country, is completely conditioned on their working for employers, which means that it's employers who are really the guardians of workers' rights. This is a way to undermine all workers' rights for everybody. This program that President Bush had proposed that right now seems to be on the back burner or maybe a dead issue, but I suspect we're going to see it reproposed in some form, is some version of it's being proposed in countries all over the world as a way to constrain and control immigrant workers. And it's very similar to the Bracero program that existed after World War II, which was a means of exploiting Mexican workers in the United States on a guest worker basis, as they call it in Germany, for example. Where the agricultural producers, particularly in California, today it'll also be the maquiladora kinds of economy on the border, are able to get access to cheap labor without any of the costs of social rights that workers in the United States had come to expect.
I must admit I looked over at Ken a moment ago when you were discussing a general strike in Italy and 1 million workers coming out to protest.
I'm envious.
I think we both are, seriously envious, which takes me back to that whole question of
any country but the U.S.
of immigration linked to structural adjustment and the new formations that form as workers come here. And just picking off on Ken saying any country but the U.S., I'm not clear that that's true. After Seattle, I'm not clear that's true after the activity in New York with the World Economic Forum. What are some of those new possibilities for those formations of the working class as people are pushed out of their country and become the new immigrants here?
Well, I think the first thing is that the movement that kind of appeared in the U.S. in a large form around the time of the Seattle demonstrations was one that was educated about the conditions in the world by some knowledge, some interaction with people who were in the countries that were in debt. So the demand, for example, to cancel the third world debt comes from interaction with people from these countries who had been fighting the debt. The movement wasn't born in Seattle in 1999. There have been rebellions against the debt and the IMF in country after country for the last 15 years or so. But immigrant workers bring knowledge and experience of these struggles with them. They come here you'll find that people from almost any country know what the IMF and World Bank are, and it's people in the U.S. and Europe are the ones who are least likely to know what they are. So that knowledge is being brought into movements in the United States and Europe by peoples from Latin America, Central America, Africa, Asia, so forth. Another very concrete example of what that can mean is that in the run-up to September 11th, as many people may remember, there were planned to be IMF World Bank meetings, the annual meetings in Washington, D.C., and demonstrations that were going to be the next step of the anti-globalization movement were going to take place in late September. These were all canceled afterwards. But at the time, the anti-globalization movement that was focusing on Washington was attempting to raise issues of the debt, for example, but was not yet really raising issues of immigrant workers. But increasingly, we were meeting with Mexican workers who were in the United States, with workers from Latin American countries, who were raising issues like amnesty for immigrant workers and the Plan Colombia kinds of U.S. military interventions going on in parts of Latin America as a part of their demands. They were bringing very concrete problems to an anti-globalization movement, in a sense, to make it a more of an anti-globalization movement. That is, to understand that to call for canceling the debt and to call for amnesty for immigrant workers is to call for the defense of the very same people, because these are often people who've lost their livelihood from structural adjustment programs and the debt, who are then coming to, say, the U.S., where they're exploited and need amnesty and need access to rights.
In the last chapter of your book, there's a chapter called The Planetary Working Class, and I wanted to ask you about the planetary working class. What is that, and how real is that?
I think it's a real possibility. That's the conclusion I come to in the last chapter of the book. I should say the word planetary is not the most elegant word in the world, but I try to avoid the use of the word global. I've come to the conclusion that global and globalization are sort of capitalist slogans. They're very ideologically laden. There's this idea that, you know, they conjure up the idea that Coca-Cola and Microsoft are bringing everybody in the world together, kind of the way you see on TV commercials. So by planetary, I just wanted to suggest that workers around the world, across the whole planet, were increasingly facing, if not similar conditions, at least forms of exploitation and problems caused by the same institutions, by the same multinational corporations, by the same transnational institutions like the IMF and the World Trade Organization, and that in through immigration flows, the demands and struggles of people from the countries of the south of the world and the demands and struggles of people in the north of the world were meeting each other. Now, that doesn't guarantee that people are going to unite or get along together, but I at least give some examples in the last chapters of my book in which, and, you know, I sort of raised one of them about how the immigrant struggle in 1990 helped rejuvenate the whole labor movement in Italy, in which peoples across national boundaries were uniting. I give an indication that, for example, workers from Senegal and Ghana and Morocco and Yugoslavia and Romania and Italy are joining the same unions as Italian workers in very high numbers, very high percentages, that there were some struggles to get the right to vote in municipal elections, and that when that was partially won, immigrant workers voted not on the basis of nationality, but for people who had stood out from different nationalities, who had stood out as leaders for the rights of immigrants as a whole. So that increasingly there's at least a chance that these various networks that are coming into contact with each other from different countries are creating something new, some new forms of class organization.
I'm interested in some of your opinions about the organized labor movement here and their response to immigrant populations. The Needle Trade Union, UNITE, formerly known as the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, both you and I have worked for that union, were very receptive to immigrant workers. Their base historically has been immigrant workers, and therefore they took more progressive stance on international policies, etc. So many of the other unions have been extremely chauvinistic and backward. So when you discuss issues of new formations in the working class and how immigrants begin to organize and work here, how does that gel in conjunction with some of the positions of the organized labor unions around immigrant workers?
Well, I think both here and in Europe, and I think it's remarkable, even given, Ken, you were kind of suggesting that the labor movement in Europe, you know, is capable of things that we haven't done here. But I think what's really remarkable is how similar this process is. That is, that unions have been at first very resistant to deal with the question of immigration, to accept or organize immigrant workers. That's true both in the countries in Europe and in the United States, and that really the initiative was taken by immigrant workers. Now, it's certainly true that UNITE has, in recent years, been much more progressive on these issues, as well as on kind of international trade issues. I'm showing later this evening at a class I'm teaching at Montclair State, I'm showing Bread and Roses, which your listeners should go straight to Rent or find a way to see a great movie about the Justice for Janitors movement. That particular film takes place in Los Angeles. So there's been some examples where immigrant workers have been the cutting edge, really, the leading edge of new unionization efforts. At the same time, we can't say that the labor movement as a whole in the United States or in Europe has really taken this issue up as a new opportunity to organize and organize, as a new opportunity to really move politically, but that there's been very forward-looking, very wide-awake elements in unions both here and there that have been aware of the need to do something to change the kinds of demands, for example. I mean, it was a very big victory when the FL-CIO came out in favor of amnesty for immigrant workers recently. But of course, concrete steps in organizing immigrant workers are needed, and that's happened a lot in California, somewhat in New York. I'm not sure how much it's happened in the rest of the country.
But they haven't taken on issues like structural adjustments, or when even the steel workers, the famous image now of steel workers and turtles marching together, environmentalists in Seattle, they're certainly not coming to it from the perspective of curbing structural adjustment to build up an equitable trade policy, et cetera, in the world community.
Right, and when they have, it's been very hesitant, or it's been one day they're at a demonstration around the debt, and the next day they're also demanding restricted. I think that what's much more interesting right now is that lacking a really full commitment yet by the official labor movement, immigrant workers have been forming their own organizations. Everything from the Chinese Restaurant Workers Association to the Taxi Workers Alliance, who had an appearance at this conference this past weekend at NYU on race and class. Who were very impressive. There's all sorts of immigrant worker centers. So there's been a way in which lacking really getting the resources and attention from the official labor federations, immigrant workers are forming their own organizations that are based around class perspectives but also around their own needs. I guess all of our hope is that somehow that will find a place within the labor movement as a whole and that there won't be this sort of tension. But I think the history of the labor movement, especially in this country, is that when new groups of workers come around and they don't find an entree into the unions as they exist, that they form their own movements. That's how the CIO got started, after all, with industrial workers.
This may be a bigger question than it should be at this point, but the migration to the U.S. sort of was downplayed for a while until last 10, 15 years, but around the turn of the last century, in the 1900s, there was much greater waves of migration to this country. How do you compare that to what's happening now, and especially in terms of rejuvenating unions?
Well, there's a very important point or two to make about this. The first is that what actually stopped that flow of immigration, which was predominantly from Europe, some from the Caribbean in the 20s, but up until World War I, predominantly from Southern and Eastern Europe. And what ended those massive flows of immigration that created our image of the United States as a country of immigration was the fears on the part of people in power in the United States that immigrants were bringing radical ideas to the United States and causing trouble. They were bringing anarchist or Soviet or socialist ideas or communist ideas, or getting involved in the labor movement, something which in fact had some truth to it, although it was also, of course, exaggerated into this sort of menace to American society. So one of the lessons is that there's a great risk that immigration as a whole, as a positive cultural and social phenomenon in U.S. history, has often been very fragile when there's been accusations that immigrants represent a threat to the society. And so I think we see something dangerously analogous to what happened after World War I happening right now. The other point to make is that this immigration is coming from countries in, say, the south of the world, but that these immigrations are every bit as organized by family networks, by people wanting to improve their condition in life, by people trying to get access to new forms of work and to better wages and conditions, as when Jews came from Russia, people came from southern Italy, like my own relatives 100 years ago, and so forth. So in some ways, it's very analogous. The difference is, of course, that the government at that time, until World War I, that is from the mid-19th century until World War I, did not repress the flows of immigration, did not try to restrict them. But now that people are coming from Mexico, from Latin America, from China, from Africa, you find that there's an attempt to restrict and control the flow. And I don't think that there's any really logical or reasonable a way to account for the difference between how, say, Italians were allowed to arrive without many restrictions and all of the sort of propaganda about restricting immigration from the southern parts of the world, except for, of course, the ongoing racism that often dominates political discourses in the United States.
Well, Steve, we're definitely going to have you back again because there's so much we haven't even touched on, and of course you've been involved in other scholarly works as well. But I remember Ken and I once called each other up with great joy. We had been watching not one of your more profound scholarly endeavors, but Star Trek on TV. And one of the aliens was miffed at his brother, and he was going to begin to organize workers who were being oppressed.
What was his name? I forget.
Was Quark.
Right,
who
Quark.
Was the bad, bad.
Oh, right.
And all of a sudden, as he began to write down this kind of charter for organizing the workers, and I began to say, my goodness, they're quoting almost verbatim from Marx and from Capital. It was remarkable.
Well, he said, workers of the world, unite.
But
with that quarking and accent.
Absolutely.
Ferengi accent, sorry.
Ferengi.
Shouldn't it be plural, workers of the world, unite by that point?
Absolutely.
Maybe he did say, I'll have to listen. Before we leave, though, tell us where people can get a copy of your book.
Wait, the question was, actually, not before we leave, the question was, and the segue into there, was your work, The Workers of the World. There aren't that many times when one is seen in popular culture the permutations of or concepts around workers organizing, much less quotes from Marx in popular culture. And you've named your book Workers of the World, African and Asian Migrants in Italy in the 1990s. Obviously, Marx plays a critical role. And what's the significance of workers of the world? Why is that still a pertinent phrase?
Well, there were two things I wanted to do with the title. One was to be provocative, because if one remembers the period, say, of the mid-1990s, this was certainly not something that was in fashion, right? I mean, it seemed like, Marxism was just, sort of buried under piles of whatever. There were other ways in which people were talking about politics, but the idea that workers across countries had something in common was not the way people thought about politics. The other thing was somewhat ironic. That is, I wanted to say that for all of the ways in which the socialist movement had raised the issues of workers of the world, it had sometimes left out the kind of people who are in my book, that is, Ghanaian cocoa farmers, there's people from Ghana who go to work in furniture factories in northern Italy, or peanut farmers from Senegal who find themselves working in machine shops and joining unions. These were not the images of workers of the world that I think at least the European socialist movement really projected, and yet these are, for my money, these are increasingly the workers of the world.
Well, Steve Colatrella, your book is Workers of the World, African and Asian Migrants in Italy in the 1990s. We will have you back, notwithstanding Ferengis and Quark. And
tell us the publisher.
Thank you. I wanted to ask if I could make a pitch.
You got a librarian here, so.
Africa World Press and the Red Sea Press, which is a great independent publisher. And I really learned a lesson about how important it is to have small independent publishers that will print certain types of work that might not make it into the larger kinds of publishing houses.
Well, again, Steve Colatrella, Workers of the World, African and Asian Migrants in Italy in the 1990s. The press again is?
Africa World Press and Red Sea Press.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you. We will absolutely have you back. There's so much in this book and so much knowledge that you possess that we need to find out a great deal more about. And, of course, this is WBAI in New York City, 99.5 FM, and the program is Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report, with myself, Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash, and I wanted to invite people to a program next week to honor the women of the WBAI Pacifica struggle. That's going to be on Wednesday, March 13th at 6 p.m. at District Council 37, 125 Barclay Street in the City Hall area, and you'll hear Amy Goodman, Sharon Louise Harper, Janice K. Bryant, and somebody who here who I don't really think I've met, Mimi Rosenberg. And if you want more information about that, you can call 212-815-1930. That's next Wednesday, the 13th, at 6 p.m. at DC 37-125 Barclay Street in the City Hall area.
And we're getting ready for a segment on the National Writers Union. With us in the studio is Joel Washington, who is one of the people who helped organize the wonderful conference that was held 2 weekends ago that Steve Colatrella referred to. The base of that conference was W.E.B. Du Bois. But Joel is coming to us in a different capacity today as a member and officer in the National Writers Union. And we'll give you the exact title, which is?
What, the National Writers Union New York Local?
No, your exact title.
Oh, right. I'm co-chair of the New York Local National Writers Union, which has 1,700 members of the 7,200 member strong National Writers Union, the freelance writers union in the United States.
And Diane Killian, who is a journalism organizer.
Yeah, she's Diane.
Diane.
Yeah.
And I'm also director of the Publication Rights Clearinghouse.
Well, it's a pleasure to have both of you with us. Diane, why don't you begin to discuss one of the issues that has come up for the National Writers Union, which I may tell our listeners, who knows, the unpaid, unwaged staff here may become part of it sometime in the fairly immediate future.
Well, I think many people are familiar with the Writers Union from the case Ticini versus the New York Times, which, of course, we won last year at the level of the Supreme Court. And what this case concerned is the use of writers' work electronically, secondary use without their permission. Basically, when the Internet was developed, publications such as the New York Times started using freelance writers' work on their website. They started selling it to aggregators who then were offering it for sale via LexisNexis, Northern Light. And the writers went back and said, hey, wait a minute, you know, this is our copyright. You can't use this work without our permission. And the New York Times and other companies tried to argue that they had bought, in effect, all rights to the work. And this case went as far as the Supreme Court, and we won last year. But the battle is not over, over electronic rights. There are many publications that, rather than doing the right thing now, the fair response to the Supreme Court's decision is to pay writers fairly for additional use of their work. But rather, many publications, including the New York Times, is now bullying writers or attempting to bully writers into signing unfair work-for-hire all-rights contracts, and the union is still aggressively engaged in the battle to get publications such as the New York Times, AOL Times Warner, and the Boston Globe to offer reasonable and fair contracts to freelancers that are consistent with the 1976 Copyright Act and are consistent, in fact, with the U.S. Constitution. I mean, copyright is written into the U.S. Constitution itself, and that's what we're trying to defend.
Yeah, I just want to add to that, just for clarification for the audience. The Writers Union's, union's position is one payment, one use. That's the ideal. In other words, you use an author's work, you pay them, and then each time you use it, you pay them. Now, what happens here is that the work-for-hire contract is one of the is the worst form of arrangement, because basically what they're saying is that you're an employee of the company, and everything that you write, you don't even get authorship with a work for hire contract. So, in other words, you don't get paid. You get paid once, and that's it. You don't even get recognized as the author of the particular publication. And we argue that Time Warner is too big to be squeezing individual freelance writers in that way. And so this case arose over a Time Inc. publication called Ski and Skiing Magazine, two different magazines, in which they tried to foist onto writers who contribute to them this work-for-hire contract, which we consider to be unfair, and is an arrangement that's not compatible with the large size that AOL Time Warner, this large size corporation that AOL Time Warner is. After all, we want our fair share, and we think that writers should be treated fairly. And I think Dean can add to that.
Yeah, I can add to the AOL campaign. AOL Time Warner, which of course is a huge conglomerate. I mean, we're talking about the largest internet company in the United States, one of the largest, Warner, television cable companies, and then Time Inc., which owns more than 45 magazines. This company had $9.3 billion in profits last year, and yet they're refusing to pay writers a pittance more for secondary use of their work. There were 45 ski and skiing writers that signed on to a protest letter to AOL Time Warner. Many of these writers are contributing writers and editors. They've been working for Ski and Skiing for years. They're really the ones that produce these magazines. And Time Inc. told them, in effect, sign this contract or we're not going to hire you anymore. About half of those writers, about 25 of them, said, no, we're not going to be forced into signing an unacceptable contract. And now Time Inc., in effect, has blacklisted these writers from working for Time Inc. contract. We always like to remind writers that contracts, by definition, are contractual. There's a give and take in a contract. No one should be told, sign this contract or else. And I don't think anywhere else in business and markets is that acceptable. You know, if you even hire someone to paint your house, to do some work to your house, it's not a one-way arrangement. The person doing the work has certain requirements. They want to charge a certain amount. This seems to be, for the publishers, you know, the only case where they feel that they can just tell whoever works for them, you know, this is what we're going to do, end of story, and not even discuss it.
Go ahead, Ken.
No, I just wanted to separate this. Now, this is the same complaint that you have against the New York Times, though, isn't it?
Yes, in effect, yes.
And what I wanted to ask is, how does this tie into the Supreme Court decision? I mean, wouldn't the decision of the Supreme Court itself sort of imply that this kind of coercion couldn't happen, or am I...
No, absolutely. In fact, we've been running regular info leaflets outside AOL Time offices, Time Inc. offices here in New York. And by the way, if anyone is interested in helping out with that leafleting campaign, we're always looking for more volunteers, and they can contact me at the National Writers Union at dndian@nw.org if you want to help out with that leafleting campaign. But absolutely, as we say in that leaflet, in effect, AOL Time Warner is flying in the face of the U.S. Supreme Court decision. The Supreme Court decision very clearly stated that additional uses of a writer's work was not being purchased when it was purchased for the first use in a newspaper and would, in effect, have to be negotiated for separately. Rather than doing that, these publications are trying to force writers to give up additional uses to their work. So it very much flies in the face of what the Supreme Court decided, and these publishers feel they can get around it because, frankly, you know, there's an imbalance of power, the lone freelancer against these huge corporations, and it's exactly that imbalance of power that the writers' union consistently is trying to correct, and it's only by joining together and collectively working to change the industry that I think we're really going to have any impact on the industry.
Yeah, I just would add to that, Ken, a little wrinkle that's slightly different with the AOL Time Warner piece is that Times Magazine, the Times Company, they had writers' articles in a database, and they said that database publishing, making those articles available electronically was not the same as publishing them, and so therefore we didn't have rights to them. That was one piece. In the AOL Time Warner piece, they're saying, look, either you take it or leave it alone. Leave it. In other words, we're offering you one payment for a work-for-hire contract, and after that, you don't get paid. We get the chance to use your work any way we want to. In fact, your name may not even be on it because you were a staff member. You see what I'm saying? So there's a slightly different wrinkle. So, but the point is that the time has come for writers to organize around the country. This is what we're saying, is that the National Writers Union is a unique entity. We offer union solidarity for freelance writers. We're the only union of its kind in the country. And what we're saying is what the old message of Solidarity Forever has always said in the song Solidarity Forever, talking about...
Workers of the world unite.
Precisely.
Writers of the world unite.
Yes. Yeah, that, you know, individual writer, there's, you know, the union makes us strong, but there's nothing weaker than an individual going up against a major corporation. And so this is what we're telling writers, that we have to fight back. And otherwise, we will starve to death. Either we organize or starve to death.
Well, we're going to, as with Steve Colatrella before, we're going to hear more about this. And certainly Ken and myself are looking forward to developing a much closer relationship with our sisters and brothers in the National Writers Union, which are part of the UAW, the United Automobile
Workers. That's right.
Workers.
Yeah, that's right. Which also stands for a union of all workers.
I didn't know that, but I like that. I'm going to write that on my jacket.
That's right, because the UAW, we've been organizing on college campuses. We've been organizing museum workers. We have Graphic Artists Guild.
And you even have a few stray lawyers wandering around.
Precisely. We have. Yeah, that's right. Your area is...
You're a stray lawyer now?
Yes. I'm a stray lawyer. Homeless lawyer.
Legal aid attorneys are certainly a category. Yeah.
And the UAW has certainly gone to bat for us. They've, you know, provided the major financing for these lawsuits. You know, it takes quite a bit of resources to take the New York Times all the way to the Supreme Court. And the UAW has really backed us all the way.
And Dion, Killian, how can people find out more about the campaign, that representation of freelance writers?
Well, we encourage people to visit the Writers Union website, which is www.nwu.org. And when you go to our main homepage, if you look in the left margin, you will see a section on journalists. The Writers Union represent freelance writers in all genres, so you can also, if you're interested, read about our book division, our BITE division, which represents technical instructional writers. But if you want to read about Ticini versus the New York Times and our campaigns going against AOL Time Warner, the Boston Globe, the San Diego Union Tribune, the Washington Post, you can click on the journalist section of the NWU website. And we're also encouraging people, especially if they're AOL Time Warner customers, to complain directly to AOL Time Warner about their refusal to even meet with writers. And if you're an AOL member, just, you know, email them in the comments section, or you can telephone AOL in New York at Time Inc. at 484-8198 and let them know that you want them to negotiate fairly with freelance writers for a good contract.
Dion Killian, thank you for being with us, and Joel Washington.
Thanks for having us, and welcome back. I'm so happy to see this program back on the air.
Thank you.
We needed the Labor Community Report.
It's a pleasure to be back, and a pleasure to deal with people like yourself who are an intimate part of constructing the programs and the issues that are aired over WBAI. And against the strains of Miles Davis in the background, we're going to take a brief but important look at the restoration of the death penalty and a number of salient issues within that around the country with Ron Tabak from New Yorkers Against the Death Penalty. Against the death penalty, and no matter what forum I present myself in to listen, Ron Tabak is there to appropriately rail against the death penalty, and we're going to find out a lot more today about the statutes, legislation relevant to New York State, how it overlaps with federal law, and why those of us who are staunchly in opposition to the death penalty should listen to Ron and what we can do and what's on the horizon in reference to death penalty statutes. Ron, it's a pleasure to have you with us at WBAI.
Well, I'm very pleased to be back on WBAI under its restored management.
Why don't we begin? What is happening in New York State? There's been a lot of focus in the federal arena, particularly post-911, but not as much on state legislation.
Well, first of all, there was a piece of legislation whipped through the legislature within days of September 11th, which, among other things, expands the state's death penalty to cover acts of terror that lead to death. The proponents of this bill, including Sheldon Silver, the Assembly Speaker, publicly stated when they were passing it that this was an overreaction on their part and that they doubted that it would ever be applied. In my view, this is not a proper reason to adopt laws which, despite what they said, might someday be applied. The reality is that they're already are federal laws governing acts of terrorism that do carry the possibility of the death penalty. In fact, there was a trial here in the Southern District of New York, the Manhattan Federal Court, of two different people accused and then convicted of being involved in bombing United States embassies in Africa. And after millions and millions of dollars of extra money were spent trying to get the death penalty for them, the jury returned life without parole. And the jurors who voted against the death penalty said that they did so in large part because they did not wish to make martyrs of these people. There is, therefore, no reason to have New York legislation on this subject since there already is federal legislation. And there is also no substantive reason to have the death penalty for these cases in any event, because people who commit suicide bombings or people who think that even if they're executed that they will immediately go to heaven are not going to be deterred by death penalty. And in fact, executing them is possibly going to lead to people wanting to avenge their deaths. So you haven't heard anything from these embassy bombers since they were sentenced to life without parole because they're sitting there pretty much in isolation and you likely won't hear from them again. That is a more appropriate way to deal with these things. Now, the other thing going on in New York State is that we are expecting there to be proposed, it already has been proposed, a bill in a resolution in the New York City Council that that the City Councilman Bill Perkins from Harlem introduced last year, in which there were hearings on last year, which clearly would have passed last year had it ever been allowed to be voted on, which would call upon the governor and the legislature to declare a moratorium on executions in New York State. It would not be binding on anybody because the City Council can't bind the legislature, but it would be an important expression by the body that represents the citizens of New York City that they are not eager to see us go down the road, at least without further study and exploration, that states like Illinois have gone down in implementing the death penalty at huge expense, only to find that it is so unfair and so inaccurate in who it winds up putting on death row that in Illinois, the Republican conservative governor declared a moratorium on executions and then set up a commission to study it. And their report is expected out in a month or so. And press accounts indicate that they are going to recommend extreme changes in their death penalty if it is implemented, and that at least within the commission that a majority internally voted that they would rather see the death penalty abolished. But in any case, the effort in the New York City Council is going to be to try and put them on record for a moratorium on executions. And this time, we do not any longer have a Speaker of the City Council who will bottle the legislation up, which is what Speaker Vallone did last year. Instead, Speaker Gifford Miller, who was against the death penalty, would be expected to allow it to come up for a vote. Another change for the better in New York City is that we now have a mayor who is against the death penalty, which is a substantial change from the previous mayor, and he made that clear even though he changed political parties. He had not changed his view on the death penalty, Mayor Bloomberg, and therefore, if there are highly publicized cases within New York City, one will not expect to see him screaming for the death penalty the way the previous mayor did and the way the governor does to try and put improper pressure on district attorneys to seek the death penalty. In New York State, there have already been resolutions passed by two of the major upstate cities, one of which is Rochester, and I never remember whether the other one that passed it already is Buffalo or Syracuse. But New York City, if we do it, particularly in the city that experienced the September 11th tragedies, and being the home of the UN, I think will be very important. So once we have language that Councilman Perkins ultimately comes up with for the resolution, and we have a bill number of how it will be coming forward, we will be urging people to support that effort and to urge their city council people to support that effort for a moratorium. Now, I am certainly against the death penalty. There are many people who favor a moratorium who are for the death penalty in theory, but cannot support the way it's being carried out in practice with all the problems that have been exposed about inadequate counsel, about racial discrimination in its implementation, about the courts coming under political pressure, of decisions being made by district attorneys that are totally inconsistent with other district attorneys. These kinds of problems are things that could cause people who don't have a moral position on the death penalty of opposing it to support a moratorium. And support for that view can also be gathered from a report issued this week by Professor James Liebman and colleagues at Columbia Law School, in which they found that the more often the death penalty is sought, the greater the errors are in implementing it and the greater the reversal rate is. They found that the higher the percentage of African Americans and other people of color are in a community, the higher the rate of error is, the worse the quality of legal representation is, the higher the rate of error is. And this doesn't even count as error cases where a person is precluded from raising their claims because the lawyer negligently did not object, where there is a major error, but they don't get relief until a second time through the courts, and they do win the case then. He's counting that as not having been an error. So this greatly understates the degree of error. And I guess there's one other New York-specific event that occurred this week that I view as significant, and that is the election of Liz Krueger in the state Senate election on the east side over Assemblyman Ravitz. Now, Liz Krueger went out of her way in all of her campaign advertising and literature to point out that unlike Assemblyman Ravitz, and for that matter, unlike State Senator Goodman, who she's replacing, who both favored the death penalty, and in Ravitz's case, very rapidly so, that Liz Krueger outright opposes the death penalty. And while I'm not going to claim that that is the major reason why she won that election by such a landslide, the fact is that a belief, which I believe is false, has been prevalent among people in the political circles that to be against the death penalty means you can't win a closely contested election. I believe that is false. I believe it may be true somewhere in the bowels of Alabama. It certainly is not true in New York. It never has been true in New York. It had nothing to do with why Mario Cuomo was not reelected, which I can go into further if you want. But it isn't true, and so when we see both Mayor Bloomberg being elected and his opponent, Mark Green, both were against the death penalty, and when we now see Liz Krueger using her opposition to the death penalty and winning handily in a big upset, those may help to shift the views of politicians in this state, and who I believe are way behind public opinion on the subject of a moratorium and probably even on the death penalty itself. And the passage of a moratorium bill by the city council will further help to shift the perception of other politicians about the subject. So I think these are very important.
You were listening to Ron Tabak, head of New Yorkers Against the Death Penalty, and we're also going to have, along with Joel Washington and Deanne Killian and Steve Colatrella, Ron Tabak back because the imposition of the ultimate sanction requires our continued discourse and vigilance. And is an issue that I feel is of strategic importance for us to enlighten people on. So you, again, were listening to Ron Tabak. And Ken, I know you had an announcement.
The Cornell University Labor Studies is sponsoring a visit by trade unionist Juan Carlos Schmidt from Argentina. And that's going to be on this Friday the 8th, on International Women's Day, at the Worker Education Center at 25 West 43rd Street on the 19th floor at 6:30 this Friday. And for more information, you can call 718-369-2998. That's area code 718-369-2998.
And I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
And you've been listening to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. And never enough time, but the reality is we have a lot of time ahead of us to cover all these important issues of work, workers, and indeed, workers of the world unite. Have a good day.